I'm Bill Hammack, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. Today, I'm going to explore the meaning of shipping 12,384 pairs of shoes around the world for less than 50 cents a box. And today, I'll be talking about container ships, the blood supply, if you will, of the global economy. I'm Bill Hammack, so please join me by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Mark Levinson.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mark. Now today I really want to focus on the effects of these container and container ships, but, you know, to start, could you just give us a description of what a current container looks like and how they work?
Yes, a container is, I must say, about the most unexciting thing you could imagine. It's a box that's generally made out of aluminum. It's 40 feet long, 8 feet across, 8 or 8.5 feet high. It has a wood floor. The aluminum is riveted together. There are vertical steel members to provide some support inside, and there are two big doors in the rear. And at each corner of this box, there is a steel forging. It's called a corner fitting, so it's easy to lift this box and move it around. It's all in all a pretty simple piece of equipment.
So now, to give our listeners an idea of the size of one of these boxes, I mean, 40 foot by 8 by 8 is a little abstract.
It's what you see on the back of a truck when you're driving down the highway.
But you could also fit one of our listeners could fit all their household goods in a 20 foot container.
20 foot containers are often used for moving. That's true.
Okay, so that's a lot of stuff. I mean, how many containers are there in the world?
Millions and millions. You see estimates that run all over the place. It's hard to know exactly, and the reason for that is because if you drive past any port or rail yard, you will see stacks and stacks of abandoned containers, too. Mm-hmm. So it's not even clear how many are in use and how many are not in use. These things are just ubiquitous. They're all over the place now.
But somewhere's upwards of 10 million or more. Would that be a reasonable estimate?
That might be a reasonable guess. I mean, these are used now for... some of them are rolling warehouses. You know, they're storage units. They're used for housing. They really have become sort of multi-purpose devices at this point.
So we've looked at the box, and maybe I think most of us, if we picture a dock where this box comes in, we still picture something like From on the Waterfront. You know, the movie with Marlon Brando where he leads a crew of 100 workers to meet a newly docked ship. What does it look like today when a container comes in? How does that differ from that On the Waterfront era?
Well, I think it's useful here, Bill, to put yourself back for a minute in the way things were in the 1950s, which is what I try to do at the outset of my book. Mm-hmm. You know, back then, ships were what was called break bulk vessels. And break bulk meant that each item was basically handled separately. So you would have a ship, and it was a lot smaller than today's ships, that was, say, sailing between, you know, New York and Europe. That ship might carry 200,000 separate items. And an item might be a tire. It might be a wooden crate with a water pump inside. It might be a bale of cotton tied up with rope. It might be a bag of something or a cardboard box of something. So each of those 200,000 items had to be lifted inside the ship and stowed away and then had to be lifted outside of the ship and handled individually. So the shipping at this point was a very slow and labor-intensive process. And each time that the goods were moved from a truck to a train or a train to a ship or vice versa, everything had to be handled again. Typically, a ship would tie up at the dock and would spend a week there while all the stuff was unloaded and then the new cargo was loaded to send abroad. The container changed this entirely. Today, an average-sized container ship might carry 3,000 40-foot containers. And that container ship will be loaded in a matter of hours at a big dock. Basically, what you've got at a dock today is a big parking lot for containers, and then half a dozen enormous cranes, and I'm talking about 200 feet high perhaps, mm-hmm. with a boom that may be 150 or 200 feet long that reaches clear out across the ship. And when a ship pulls in, these cranes immediately start to work, lifting the containers off, putting them onto vehicles that take them to the parking lot. And when it gets the ship gets partially emptied, then the cranes simultaneously load and unload. All of this orchestrated in advance by computers. So it's like a factory. It's a very systematized, organized process. And you just don't see any longshoremen carrying bags of coffee on their shoulders. That's not what's going on here.
And so when these containers arrive, they are not even opened up necessarily. They're put right on a truck and then moved out from the dock to wherever they're going. Is that correct?
Well, the first priority, everything in container shipping is driven by the cost of the ship. Okay, the ship is very expensive, and so what they want to do first is get the stuff off the ship, and so everything comes off the ship, and it's basically stacked in what is a big parking lot, and there will be rows and rows of containers, four or five high, and so they will be moved from ship side to this holding area, and then they will be picked up by trucks, or they will be taken to a rail yard. So it's basically two moves.
Now, I called these containers the blood supply of the global economy.
I thought that was a good metaphor.
And, well, thank you. And I'd like to explore now really how they changed the world. So we looked at them kind of technically. They obviously changed the quantity or amount of things shipped, but did it also change exactly what was shipped? And can you give me then some examples that showed how radically they changed global commerce?
Well, in the 1950s, before the container came into use, the cost of shipping internationally could be anywhere from 10 to 25 or 30% of the value of the goods. It was expensive to ship stuff. And the main reason it was expensive to ship stuff is that you had to pay the dockers, the longshoremen, to handle it again and again and again. Everything came into the port area by truck or train, and each item had to be removed individually, stored. Then it had to be removed from the warehouse individually, loaded. So there was just a lot of labor in this whole thing. And so a lot of stuff just didn't get shipped because it wasn't worth paying the cost of this transportation process. What the container basically did is almost eliminate shipping cost as a consideration in terms of international trade. So right now, you know, people buy Australian wine. Can you imagine shipping a bottle of wine from Australia? But we're only paying a few cents a bottle for shipping costs there. Garments, clothing, you know, and we're paying just a few cents per item for the cost of transporting this from China. Whereas in the days of break bulk freight before, the shipping cost was so large for many of these things that they generally were not even shipped internationally.
So what happened then, right, is that we used to only import things that couldn't be produced domestically, such as, you know, bananas or whiskey or these kind of things were imported. But we were able to make, you know, microwaves, washing machines, and other things cheaply here. Is your argument that we no longer make those things here partly because it's so easy to ship?
The way to think about shipping costs is that they're like a trade barrier. When shipping costs were high, not only were things from abroad not imported, but often things were not even shipped domestically. Typically, port cities had very large industrial complexes right by the port to minimize shipping costs. But many cities had their own manufacturing industries that served the local area, because simply shipping something from Chicago to Atlanta might be a pretty costly process if you had to load each individual item onto a truck and then unload each individual item. So typically you had a lot of small local manufacturers back in those days. With containerization, transport costs have fallen so much, you don't really have such a thing as local markets and local manufacturers. It's really now one world economy, and the absence of transport costs, or the near absence of transport costs, is a big reason why.
I mean, it is arguable that we would not have a global economy without these container ships. Is that a fair statement?
It is certainly the case that you would not have a global economy if we were still loading all these little items on a ship one by one by one. It's just unimaginable. Today's ships handle 10 or 15 times as much cargo as a ship in the 1950s. Now, I mentioned that a ship in the 1950s might have 200,000 separate items. Envision a ship with 10 times that much, and each item, each one of 2 million items is going to be carried onto that ship by a longshoreman? I mean, you've got to be kidding. This would not be happening. So it's really the process of automation that has made this globalization possible, and the container is what lies behind that.
Now, we talked about the size of the container, the 40-foot by 8 by 8 or so. And can you give us an estimate of to ship something, say, California to the United Kingdom? Do you know roughly what that container would cost?
I can't give you a great estimate. These things change a lot, and they change a lot based on the capacity on a shipping route and on the relative demand in each direction. So, for example, if you want to ship something from the United States to China right now, it will cost you much less than if you want to ship something from China to the United States.
Because the containers are here already.
We've got a lot of containers here, and the demand for westbound shipments across the Pacific is much lower than the demand for eastbound shipments. So you may be paying a couple thousand dollars to ship a container from China to the U.S., and a few hundred dollars to ship a container from the U.S. to China.
Oh, as low as a few hundred dollars, possibly.
This varies a lot. Typically, this is an industry which, through its history, has been marked by very great rises and falls. Okay, what happens is you have new ships built. All of a sudden, there's this new capacity, and the ship owners have to fill their ships. These are expensive vessels, and if you're not carrying cargo, you're losing money. So the rates then tumble, okay? And the ship owners may lose money for a few years. The traffic picks up. The ships gradually fill up, and the rates go way, way up, and the ship owners have a couple of very profitable years. They say, hey, let's build some more ships, and you go through the cycle again. And that is pretty much the history of container shipping.
So we can see the effect that these have every day, you know, when we go shopping. But I want to explore some of the things that you look at in the book, which is really how the containers radically changed society, changed the world. And let's start with labor relations. I mean, how did containers change labor unions, and how did it affect, say, neighborhoods where day laborers or longshoremen lived?
Well, let's talk about the workers in two different sections here. First, the workers on the docks themselves. You know, I document really in my book, The Box, what happened to these. There used to be in most ports waterfront neighborhoods that supplied the bulk of the dock workforce. And the dock workforce in the pre-container days was huge because you needed enough workers to handle peak demand. And most days you didn't have peak demand, so most days you had a lot of unemployed workers. And this is how you got to the situation that everyone knows from on the waterfront, where you had these guys showing up at the pier begging for work. In New York, to give you an example, in the early 1950s, you had 50,000 dock workers. In London, in the early 1950s, you had 50,000 dock workers. We're talking about a huge labor supply. And the containers simply did away with the need for all those people. Today, in New York Harbor, New York and New Jersey, there are fewer than 3,000 longshoremen. Okay, so we're talking about a decline from 50,000 in the early 1950s to 3,000 now. And today's longshoremen handle far more cargo than all those workers did back then. So you just don't need the workers. And the waterfront community that was built around the docks then disappeared. The manufacturers could move away. They didn't need to be next to the docks in order to save on transportation. The longshoremen themselves today earn really good livings. They can live out in the suburbs if they want. And so the whole community that was built up around the waterfront basically disintegrated. The second impact on workers was really on workers in industries such as manufacturing, because now with cheap transportation, these workers find themselves competing directly with workers in other countries. And so this is a story we're all very familiar with in terms of layoffs, falling wages, givebacks or plant closures or that sort of thing, because you know you're not just competing with other workers in your town anymore. You're competing with other workers around the world, And that is really a result of the fact that goods can be transported all over the world quite cheaply.
So, you know, when you mention these workers, I think some of the numbers are startling. In the late 60s, there was 1.5 million dock workers in Manhattan, and it dropped by 91%.
You may be talking about dock worker hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But that's a whole revolution. What did it do to neighborhoods in New York?
Well, the people who lived in these neighborhoods, I in the box, my book, I took a look at Brooklyn, for example, and you went through a long period in Brooklyn in which the average income actually fell, quite aside from inflation, just in plain dollars. People in Brooklyn earned less on average than they had 10 years earlier. People moved out. That's because the dock jobs had vanished, the manufacturing jobs had vanished, the total income in the borough of Brooklyn was actually lower than it had been before, and it stayed that way for a long time. If people recall, New York had a very difficult decade in the 1970s and early 1980s, and that, I think, was directly related to the departure of the shipping for New Jersey and to the loss of all of the jobs that were attached to the waterfront. And it took a long time to recover from that. We've seen much the same phenomenon in London, in Liverpool, in San Francisco, in other traditional port cities, where these jobs just left, and it took a long time to find another economic base.
I'm talking to Mark Levinson, author of The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger. You can join the conversation today by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So you in talking about workers there, you touched a little bit on manufacturing. And in your book, you have a very provocative sentence where you say Barbie was conceived as an all-American girl, but in truth, she never was. What is it that the container ships did for Barbie? And in fact, what is it that they did to manufacturing?
Well, in the olden days, if I can call the 1950s the olden days, we had very large factories. You would use a word like integration, okay? You would have raw materials, iron ore, steel, whatever it was, coming in one end, and you would have finished products coming out the other. These days, it's very common for production to be spread around, and not just within a country, but within the world, around the world. And each phase of the production process may be done in a different place because it's very inexpensive to move partially manufactured goods from here to there. Most of what is in the containers that comes into the big ports in places like Los Angeles and Long Beach and Oakland is actually not consumer products. It's actually partially manufactured goods. And they are coming here to have further manufacturing. Okay, they've had one process done to them, and they're going to a different factory to have another process done to them. And that today is, in general, the process of manufacturing, which was not at all the case 50 years ago.
We have a caller from Urbana. So caller on line one, please go ahead.
Yes, hello. This is a fascinating program. Do I understand that it doesn't matter how much the weight of the container is, the shipping is just based on size and on the, you know, the number of units of containers. It doesn't, you know, whether it weighs 2 tons or 10 tons.
Up to the legal weight limit, yes, that's correct.
What is the weight limit for one of these?
Well, actually, the weight limit is determined by the highway in the state or the country that you're going to. So in the U.S., in the U.S. in general, the container can't be more than about 68,000 pounds because by the time you put it on a truck, you're at the highway weight limit in most states. In other countries, the limit is higher. But the charge is really based on it's a per container charge.
Right. Yeah.
And this was one of the early adaptations they had problems with because when containerization started, all freight rates, of course, were regulated in those days. And the rate was supposed to be based on what was inside the container, except the ship line or the railroad or the trucking company didn't actually know what was inside the container.
Right.
It didn't open it. And if you had a mixed container, by the way, the freight rate was supposed to be based on the mixture. So if you had, you know, 10 tons of this inside a container, you had to charge 10 tons of this times the rate per ton for that commodity plus 5 tons of this times the rate, you know. And again, the ship line had no idea what was inside. So in principle, at least, it was supposed to open the container and figure out what all was inside. And that obviously wasn't a workable system. So eventually we moved to this system where the rates are flat.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about opening containers, of course, the current news about shipping, or the most recent general news, is the question of security at the ports.
Right.
So can you address that at all in relation to these closed containers?
Sure. This has been a problem now for many years. The nature of the problem changed. You know, it used to be we were concerned about marijuana coming in containers, right? And then we were concerned about illegal immigrants, and now it's nuclear weapons. But the basic issue is really the same, which is it's very hard to know what's in all of these things. And you can't easily check. I mean, if you go and open the back door of a container, in most cases what you're going to see is a lot of cardboard boxes. You know, you're not going to see much. So we've got devices that now X-ray containers and sniff for chemicals and sniff for radioactive weapons. But the reality is that there is not a great way of knowing what's inside these sorts of things. The number that is actually physically searched is very small. And if it were very big, we would have no way at all of doing it, because it can take several days to thoroughly search a single container.
Well, the numbers I've heard is that fewer than 4% of these are scanned in the U.S. I mean, how much should we worry about dirty atomic bombs and radiological bombs and things coming in? Is this a legitimate worry, or is this overblown?
Well, there are a lot of legitimate worries, and this is one, okay? So whether this is actually more of a danger to the country than a guy buying 10 tons of fertilizer and setting it off, you know, I will leave for you to judge, because there are a lot of possible terrorist threats. But the reality is that we don't know what's in most of those containers, and it's very hard to know. At this point, this stuff essentially works on the honor system. Okay, if you are a shipper who's known to the U.S. border security people, you probably have a regular pattern. Okay, you probably send a container every Thursday to Los Angeles or something like that. They know it's coming. They know who you are. They know where it's going, and they're not going to bother you. And if you're a new shipper, if you're somebody that the border security people have never heard of, or if you're shipping it to somebody who's unknown to them, they're more likely to take a look. So basically, this is not the greatest security system in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of how this works today.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So, you know, you mentioned a number of things here that indicate that the containers and containership changed governments, changed regulations, laws, and insurance. Can you tell me a little bit about how maritime law was affected by this? Did this change things?
Oh, I mean, maritime law is a subject all by itself. Yeah, I mean, the just to give you one example, you know, there was an enormous problem with lost cargo. Okay, suppose a container vanishes overboard, which happens from time to time, and it used in the early days of containerization, it happened more.
But what do you mean they disappear overboard? I mean, are they not strapped down? How does
this
happen?
Well, if a container ship, for example, ends up in a severe storm, okay. Sometimes containers will they are tied down, but sometimes containers will go off the boat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This happened much more frequently in the early days of containerization, but it still happens. Well, the ship line, again, doesn't know what was in the container. So how do you compensate whoever owned the merchandise? This is a sort of a basic question of maritime law, and the ship line hasn't verified what was shipped. It didn't open the container and say, aha, you know, there are actually 3.6 tons of men's shirts in here or whatever. You don't know. There were whole issues related to who owned the container, who was responsible for returning the container. I mean, the legal system took a long time to catch up with the container, so it was not just a question of maritime law. Back in the early days, just to give you an example, when people shipped internationally by container, the customs services of the various countries typically assessed duties not only on the contents but also on the container.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Mark Levinson, author of The Box, a book about shipping containers. Levinson has been an editor at The Economist, a writer for Newsweek, an editorial director for the Journal of Commerce. He's also written for Foreign Affairs and for the Harvard Business Review. And you can join me today by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Well, we've talked about a number of aspects of commerce and insurance and, you know, law and legislation that this has changed. How has it changed retailing? Do companies like Walmart and Dell operate any differently, or are they even made possible by these container ships?
You couldn't imagine Walmart without a container. I mean, you know, Walmart gets a lot of its advantage from its logistical systems, and Walmart is famous around the world for its logistical systems. Logistics has to do with acquiring and managing the flow of goods into your stores. And so Walmart and all of the other large retail chains are now free to shop around the world for the cheapest place to make whatever it is that they want to sell. They're not really limited by some particular set of manufacturers here in the U.S. because it costs too much to buy it abroad. So it has absolutely opened the door to retailing, discount retailing. And you know, for consumers, as I write in the book, the container has been really a mixed blessing because on the one hand, it did eliminate a lot of jobs in longshore work, in waterfront manufacturing, in a number of other areas. On the other hand, it really enables you to go to the store and buy stuff that you could not possibly have bought before at very low prices.
So Walmart, they're really, their entire business strategy is about moving stuff from the factory floor direct to the consumers in a minimum amount of time. And from what I can gather, they're one of the largest Pacific shippers in the business. So has Walmart ever considered starting its own container shipping company?
They don't want to, I'm sure. I've not talked to Walmart about it, but there's no need to. One of the things that has changed and is really very important to the success of the container is transport regulation. You know, people have paid a lot of attention to deregulation when it has to do with, say, plane tickets, but freight transportation was deregulated as well, starting in the mid-70s and going as late as the late 90s. And what deregulation has meant is that it's no longer necessary that a transportation company charge every shipper the same price. Okay, that used to be the rule for trucks and trains and ships. Everybody got the same price per ton. Now a customer like Walmart can negotiate. It can go to a ship line and say, we would like to ship 10,000 containers a month from Shanghai, China, to Long Beach, California. What price will you give us? And will you guarantee delivery within X days? Okay. It can negotiate whatever terms it can negotiate concerning the price, concerning the delivery time. If it cares about the route, it can negotiate over the route, the damage to the cargo. I mean, it can set any standards it wants. And as long as it can find a ship line and other transportation companies willing to negotiate with it, it can strike its own deal. So that's really given a big advantage to smart companies that are able to negotiate these kinds of contracts.
I want to go ahead and take a caller. We have a caller in Belden, Illinois. Caller on line 4, please go ahead.
Yes. you happen to slightly mention this topic that I bring up, but about containers going overboard. And containers going overboard become quite dangerous because where they're at, they're in the shipping lanes. And you've got a floating container, weighs, like you say, several tons, and you run a ship into it. Where does the liability go to? You know, you could be quite possibly sink another ship, definitely damage it. If the things spill from this container, it could very well be an environmental catastrophe, depending upon what it is, where it opens at. And then they could also float to the bottom of the sea and pose some problems there. Is there any legislation, any activity in this area?
Not that I'm aware of. I've got to say that I think that the problem of lost cargo is probably in some ways less with container ships than it was previously. Container ships tend to be pretty large, and most of them are pretty modern. I mean, you've still got some old ones around. But this is now, the shipping industry now is an industry of very large companies operating very modern vessels. And this is quite different from the 1950s, 1960s, when you had a lot of small companies operating one or two rust buckets. You had a lot of really dodgy ships out there on the water, and sometimes you know, an entire ship would go down. So in general, I think that this has tended to become a bit more modern. And the one discipline you've got now that you didn't have then, I was describing a minute ago, the contracts that you've got between shippers and ship lines. And so you've got shippers paying attention to this. And a company that is believed to have unsafe practices, that loses a disproportionate amount of cargo, it's going to lose its business. Mm-hmm. And so you really have a certain kind of discipline there that didn't used to be in the system very much. That said, when one of these things goes overboard, it's a danger. There's no question about it.
Well, the caller raised an interesting point. I'm reminded of David Letterman's skit, Will It Float? Do containers actually float, you know, or do they sink?
Both.
Both?
Yeah. I mean, you know, typically stuff will float for a while and eventually go down.
Okay.
Sometimes it'll float for a few days and people will be able to retrieve it if they get there quickly enough.
Hmm.
But typically this happens, you know, in very difficult weather and very stormy situations. You know, you get out there on the seas with very high waves, and it can be fairly stressful. And again, this is an area where I think there has been some significant improvement over the years. When containerization first started, people who did it were feeling their way in a lot of respects. They didn't really understand all of the different stresses that could occur and how they needed to be prepared for them.
Well, I want to look at another way that we can lose things that are shipped, and that's through pilferage, through crime. Now, certainly the idea of a container ship was it's harder to pilfer something. Have there been cases, though, where criminals have stolen whole containers? Is that common at all?
Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely. Containers vanish. Now, in the olden days, when you had break bulk freight, stuff vanished, and it was really easy to steal. So things like whiskey or wristwatches or jewels or things like that just often never made it where they were going. And one of the big advantages of the container was that it did cut down on theft at the docks. Pilferage was eliminated. So now, if you want to steal, you've got to steal a whole container.
Mm-hmm. But there is an organized way to do this. I mean, it happens at times.
It is organized crime. There's no question mm-hmm. about it. The security at container yards themselves has improved a lot. You don't have to go back very far, and the container yards were fairly open. It really wasn't very hard to get in. Mm-hmm. These days, it is. Mm-hmm. You can't just show up and bring your truck in and hook up to a container. And so it's harder to do this. But remember that these things, once they leave the dock area, they're on the back of a truck, mm-hmm. or they're on a rail car, which is going to take them and then shift them to a truck. And so it's quite easy to hijack the truck and drive off with it. Mm-hmm. And it does happen. There's no question.
So we've seen here the huge impact, I mean, socially, politically, in terms of trade. Help me to understand how these came about. I mean, if we can pinpoint it, whose idea?
The people in the transport industry had been fooling around with containers in various ways for a long time. We've had containers since the late 1900s, and nobody ever made any money with them. In the mid-1950s, a trucker by the name of Malcolm McLean decided to go into the container business. McLean had built from a single truck what was then the third biggest trucking line in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And McLean was concerned that this was now after World War II. There was a big increase in traffic, and there still weren't very many expressways. And McLean was concerned that highway congestion was going to be bad for his trucking business, which was along the Atlantic coast. And so he had the idea, suppose we buy a ship, drive the truck on board a ship, and take the ship down the coast rather than driving through all this traffic. So that's where he started, and then it occurred to him, hey, you know, if we drive this truck on board the ship, the wheels take up all this space for no particular purpose, why don't we just lift the back off the truck? And that's really where the modern version of containerization began. McLean sold his trucking company and really bet all his chips on the container.
Mm-hmm.
His company became Sealand Service, which was the biggest ship line in the world for a while.
Now, one still sees their containers.
Well, their company is now owned by Maersk of Denmark,
okay,
which is the world's biggest ship line. And mm-hmm. Maersk now, I had mentioned a minute ago that these were now very large companies. Maersk has bought up half a dozen different major ship lines, probably owns in excess of 500 container ships. 500 ships, okay, this is big, big business.
Mm-hmm. So you were saying he sold off his trucking firm, and he actually put all of his efforts and energies and money into a shipping line.
He started carrying containers between New York and Houston, mm-hmm. and built up a domestic business, and then went to Puerto Rico, carrying freight mostly between New York and Puerto Rico. And then starting in the 1960s, we had container shipping across the North Atlantic for the first time. But what really got containerization going was the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War was essential, you're saying, to containers?
There was a lot of speculation about what containers would be efficient for and what they wouldn't be efficient for. And a lot of people said, you know, containers, they're okay along the coast. They're kind of a niche product. They really won't work over long distances. Well, the U.S. got itself into Vietnam, and we had this enormous logistical problem of we increased our troop strength in Vietnam very rapidly in the mid-60s. There was no logistical system at all in Vietnam, a broken-down railroad, a couple of docks. That was about it. Cargo started piling up on the docks, and it didn't get to the troops. And McLean kept trying to tell the military, hey, you know, if you try containers, that might solve this. And the military was very resistant to this, you know, it was not invented here. And finally, it became a big embarrassment to the U.S. military. The magazines did articles showing cargo rotting on the docks of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put out an urgent request for help and finally agreed to give McLean's company a contract to carry goods in containers from the West Coast to Vietnam. So McLean built his own container port, basically, at Cam Ranh Bay. Put seven ships into service, hauling stuff back across the Pacific, and straightened out what was a huge logistical mess in a matter of months. And that's really what convinced people that even in across long distances, in very complicated situations, the container was an efficient way to do business.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really is what kindled the growth of containerization.
One of the things you note is he would bring these ships over with materiel for the Vietnam War and have an empty ship in Asia and actually begin to ship things back here. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, McLean was a smart guy, and he had he arranged this contract where with the military where he did have to perform, okay? But if he performed, his contract carrying freight from the U.S. to Vietnam would pay for running the ship both ways. So any cargo he could get going back to the U.S. was gravy. And so he looked around and said, well, what can we do with these things? Well, does anybody know anything about Japan? And pretty soon McLean's ships were stopping off in Japan, picking up electronics and bringing them back to the West Coast. And that was really the beginning of the wave of Japanese consumer exports to the United States. Television, stereos, the kinds of products that previously were expensive to ship and that tended to get stolen a lot. They were great in containers. Containers were perfect. And so this really opened the way to the Asian consumer goods coming to the U.S.
Mark, we have another caller. We have a caller from Champaign. So caller on line one, please go ahead.
Hello. I have a question from an Illinois perspective. Since we're not on a coast, I was interested in some of the impacts of this in our area. Could you comment how materials get in containers either through the Lake Michigan or the St. Lawrence Seaway or whatever, or also how much traffic there is on the trains, especially the Union Pacific, And there are many warehouses starting to pop up along the interstate highways that don't appear to be very close to the major rail hubs in Chicago or any waterways that I can see. But there must be some reason why these places are cropping up like mushrooms. I'd be interested in your comments on any of those points. Thank you.
Sure. Containers had a huge impact on places like the ones you're describing. The initial movement of industry out of the port areas was actually into rural areas. Okay, it pre-container, at the docks, you had these warehouses, very, very large warehouses, and you had factories right there. A place like Brooklyn, for example, was one of the great manufacturing centers in the United States. Once you had containers, none of this stuff had to be near the docks. And so manufacturing then began to disperse because getting it to the docks, if you wanted to import or export, was no longer expensive. Getting your raw materials in became much less expensive. So both manufacturing and warehousing could move away from these urban areas, and that is really what set off the movement into to smaller communities. Then, of course, when you started to have the rise of international container shipping, many of these same communities found themselves facing foreign competition that they previously hadn't faced. So now the cost structure of their factory really had to compete against the cost structure of Asia plus a negligible import freight bill. And so I think you'll find plenty of places where the local factory has closed because of foreign competition, and that's the container at work as well.
Now, Mark, our caller asked a very specific question. Are these ships able to use the St. Lawrence Seaway? Are they able to go through the Great Lakes into Chicago, or is it only on the coast that this happens?
The ships can go through the St. Lawrence Seaway, and some do, but there are size limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And container shipping is an industry of economies of scale. The bigger, the cheaper per container. Okay, the bigger the port, the cheaper it is to operate the port per container. The bigger the ship, the cheaper it is to operate the ship on a per container basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the ships just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and most of the ships can't get through the St. Lawrence Seaway into a place like Chicago anymore. In general, the shippers in Chicago will put their goods on a truck or a train and send it off to a port. Conversely, when stuff is imported, there is now a huge business involved in what are called unit trains that come from the ports to places like Chicago and St. Louis. When container shipping got started, the railroads didn't want anything to do with it, and they discovered finally that they could make a lot of money off it. The railroads operate special trains that contain nothing but containers, and they move directly from the docks at Long Beach or Los Angeles or Seattle straight to a freight yard in suburban Chicago with only a stop to change crews along the way. And so they can do this and offer very rapid delivery times. And now the entire shipping process is not really from port to port anymore. It's from point to point. If you go onto the website of one of the major ship lines, such as Mediterranean Shipping or Maersk Line, you can find your own route. You can put in some inland point in Delhi, Asia, Delhi, India, and you can put in some inland point like Chicago, Illinois, and it will give you to the day a shipping schedule that involves a truck line in India, a ship voyage, a rail journey in the United States that gets you from one end to the other, and it promises you delivery by a certain date. So it's a very sophisticated operation that now reaches way inland. And in a lot of senses, the difference between a port and an inland point has gone.
Mark, this has been an absolutely fascinating hour, but we're out of time. So thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you very much for having me, Bill.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Mark Levinson, author of The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger. The technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson.